I think we'll get started here. We have, this is a joint meeting of the Health and Human Services Committee and the Healthcare and Human Services Finance Division. And we're going, it's going to be a longer meeting today so we can get through quite a bit of material. And really, what our goal here is today is to walk through a lot of the work that happened and that many of the folks in this room were involved in this over the last 8 months. In trying to learn about where our current healthcare system is and some things that we can do to improve it. And so it should be a very interesting and informative presentation. I think before we get started, Representative Abler had just a few things he wanted to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I want to welcome the nurses. It looks like it's Nurse Day, so it's always good to have nurses. My wife's a nurse, so she made me do that. Now she doesn't know you're here, so it's really good to have you here. I do want to make an announcement. The Minority Leader, Seifert, requested, and I gave him my resignation as the Minority Lead on the Health Finance Committee, so I just thought people should know that. I'm not sure who will be reappointed, but news to follow. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, let's get started. We have Commissioner Ludeman and Commissioner Magnin who will give an overview of the Transformation Task Force report. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Cal Ludeman, Commissioner of DHS for the state of Minnesota. With me is Dr. Fannie Magnin, the Commissioner of Health. Mr. Chairman, you served on the Transformation Task Force, co-chaired by myself and Representative Huntley. Two state senators were on this task force, three members of the administration, and 11 other private sector partners were on the Transformation Task Force. The basic process in itself, I think, was well accomplished. And it talked about some of the issues of the healthcare, about the urgency of it, and certainly under the premise that the status quo was unacceptable, that costs are too high, the quality too variable, and the affordability of what is happening in the healthcare has made the insurance and coverage products unaffordable to many people, particularly in the individual and small group markets. With that said, I would like, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, to turn it over to Commissioner Magnin for a few minutes to talk about the problem, and then we'll talk about some of the specific recommendations of the task force.
Thank you. That was great. Dr. Magnin.
Mr. Chair, as Commissioner Ludeman so aptly put it, we do have a problem here in Minnesota. Even though we have some of the best healthcare systems in our country, we do have problems with access to quality, affordable healthcare. And I just want to illustrate that for you graphically. Total healthcare spending between 2000 and 2005, Minnesota, went up 52%. Clearly an unsustainable growth in healthcare costs. To add to that, we also have a quality problem. You could argue that if we were spending all this money and getting good quality, that maybe it was a wise investment. But if we actually look at care for people with diabetes, that we see that for optimal care, so that includes being tobacco-free, using aspirin, blood pressure, cholesterol, glucose under control, for people with diabetes in Minnesota, we only have 11% receiving optimal care. So clearly with quality that is not at the level that it could be, and with costs increasing as it is, we have a value problem in Minnesota. Also, we have emphasis on the wrong place in Minnesota. We are not addressing root causes of disease adequately, such as tobacco, physical inactivity, and unhealthy eating. And therefore, we're seeing a rise in obesity. Obesity is made of unhealthy eating and lack of physical activity. So we're seeing an epidemic of obesity, which is contributing to our poor quality and poor access and affordability of healthcare. This is all leading with rising costs to an erosion of private insurance in Minnesota. Between 2001 and 2007, employer-sponsored coverage is eroding. And with that, we're seeing a rise in people on state programs and a rise in the uninsured. Clearly something that we do not want to see continue to erode in Minnesota, since we pride ourselves on our low uninsured rate in Minnesota. One of the things that is contributing to this is our current payment system that has misaligned incentives. And to most aptly illustrate that is that in Minnesota, we actually pay more if a doctor amputates the leg of someone with diabetes versus treating and preventing that amputation. The payment system has misaligned incentives. Therefore, we have a quality, affordability, and access problem in Minnesota with a system that focuses too much on treatment and not enough on prevention. And these were some of the information, the background that went in to the Government Transformation Task Force recommendations, which Commissioner Ludeman will tell us more about, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Ludeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are other folks to testify today, Mr. Chairman. We'll give a lot more specifics about some of the information, either directly from the task force and its recommendations or information that they helped to provide to the Transformation Task Force, which you have arranged. The basic premise of this is that the affordability issue is not all about public programs as delivered in Minnesota, that if we can't do something in the private market to provide more affordable product and benefit design within that, we will continue to lose our employee-based coverage, and we can't accomplish that affordability standard if we don't do something about the basic cost structure. The quality issue the commissioners talked about, we have new transparency in Minnesota. We're one of the most transparent healthcare states in the nation. We can feel good about that. We know more about price and quality information than almost any other state. However, it is still not showing up on any reduction in premiums or even slowing of the trend line. The basic task force recommendations are in five categories, and the further testimony will give a lot more detail about this. The first one is about what the commissioner talked about, change the dynamics of utilization of our healthcare system in the acute care system, and that means improve our health. So if we can do more about tobacco or obesity or activity, we know that over time we will start to reduce the utilization of the healthcare system as it currently exists. The second point is to improve the quality, cost, and patient-centeredness of the healthcare system. Bring the patient and the physician or the clinic system closer together, not have vehicles of organization that separate the patient from the provider community. The third is to restructure the payment system, as the commissioner spoke about. This task force makes remarkable and bold recommendations about what payment can look like. This is not an invention purely of the last 6 months in Minnesota, but it has been talked about nationwide in many forums, symposiums, national conferences. But it is left to Minnesota to be the first one to decide that this is a better way to do business and that we can reform the payment system so that we can actually get the quality of the delivery and the health of Minnesotans rather than simply the volume of care delivered. The recommendation talks about three basic levels of care. I won't go into a great deal about them. The first one is sometimes referred to as a medical home, sometimes called the physician-directed care. The second level is more care coordination at the provider level, not at the insurance level or the health plan level. And level three is a little more complex to describe, but it is a total cost of care bidding process for providers who have the ability to make a total cost of care bid that the patient provider or the patient or the employee benefit manager or the insurance company in and of themselves can accept those bids if they are satisfactory. This is mostly to put the provider on the clinical and medical cost, taking the total cost of care on the clinical side, not necessarily all of the insurance risk. The fourth bullet is to reduce the overall size and cost of the healthcare system itself. The recommendation or the legislation which commissioned this task force to do its business was to try to reduce the healthcare costs by 20% in a relatively short period of time. We had to stretch out the time to achieve that 20%. But I think that is a realistic examination of the numbers about what it can actually realistically do to change the trend line in healthcare costs. After we do that, after we have done something about reducing this cost, we can really talk about what we've done for the 93% of Minnesotans who are insured so that they have a better satisfaction in the delivery of healthcare system at a quality level, and a good competition and quality choices, both based on price and quality. And we can do something about this, folks who are currently uninsured. There may be an ability to recapture some of the savings that can be accomplished in this change of this system so that we can then help people receive access or more affordable health care coverage in Minnesota. The next slide is the best current representation that takes a little while to get on the screen. I'm confident that it will. Do you have paper versions? Okay, thank you. But this is the, in capsule form, this is what this is about. The four things in the corners are the things that I just talked about in those first four bullets: the payment reform, the insurance market reform, the administrative efficiency and information infrastructure, which I didn't speak to. As you know, with the help of this legislature, Minnesota has reached, has achieved some new a new mandated administrative efficiency through the uniformity of coding and the electronic transfer of medical information, so that we are HIPAA compliant, privacy protected, but able to do this in a more administratively simply way. This should reduce the back office costs of both the providers and the back or front office costs of insurance companies or health plans in Minnesota. And the fourth one was the prevention and the health promotion that we, that the commissioner already talked about. This then gives us, we think, the access to the quality, affordable health care in Minnesota in the near future. The last slide is about how you could look at it from a different perspective. What we currently have in Minnesota is a medical arms race that drives health care costs higher. We have a lot of sick care, in other words, acute health care delivery system that, as the commissioner talked about, is about the current episodes of walking into either an emergency room or a clinic or a hospital to receive that appropriate care. For those two things, we could change that to a population health perspective, and we could change it to a preventive and planned care environment. We also have invisible, this is less true today as it was a year ago, but in relatively invisible quality and cost information. I call this the black box of healthcare. We need to put a window in that black box and make very visible the quality and cost information. There are current progressive providers and health plans in Minnesota currently doing this at a very fast rate, and we are trying to achieve more uniform and measurable ways to display that information. We also currently have visit-centered care. We have primary care physicians who are lining up 30, 32, 35 office visits each day. That they have to do that to preserve the business viability of their clinic. This is what results in 7 or 8 minutes of encounter on the part of the patient with the physician. If we switch this to a patient-centered care and the better care coordination, we could find that not only the physician, but the nurse practitioner, the registered nurses, the nurses' aides, all of the other folks who would then be have the ability to work at the top of their license, as we say, could be part of this system to get the patient what they need. The fragmented care is this basic network that we currently have with some clinics in integrated systems, some not. Some with privileges to admit patients in some hospitals, some not. Some in a network of insurance company plans at different tiered levels. A great deal of confusion that has resulted in fragmented care. We could go to a care coordinated model where there could be reward for those systems, those clinics that are able to coordinate the care at the provider level. This would all be good for the health and the predictability on the part of the patient so that they would have truly finally coordinated care where it belongs. There's been a lot of talk even across Minnesota and across this nation about the waste and the rework that currently goes on with medical care. How many tests are reordered, how much paperwork needs to be transferred to be able to get just the administration of the entry into a clinic system delivered. We then have to move to this administrative simplification, which I feel very confident we are working very hard through something called the Administrative Uniformity Committee, which reports to Commissioner Magnin, is making great progress. And lastly, this incentive for the endless inflation, this acceptability of what is called medical trend has to stop, that the status quo has to end, and that we can actually put in incentives both at the patient and the provider level for this cost-effective, high-quality care in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, in very brief summary, that's what the Transformations Task Force spent 6 months talking about, researching, and exchanging about 3 million words on written paper about.
There were probably that many words, you're right.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming down today. And members, we're going to get into the details of these with some other testifiers, but we really appreciate you taking the time to come and visit with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. I did want to announce that the basement hearing room is set up for overflow, so you can hear what's going on if you're interested in having a seat instead of standing around. So it's up to you, but it will only be available till 2:15. So the second half of the meeting, we don't have that room available. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm just going to give a brief introduction. If you look at the agenda, you'll see there's a whole host of people lined up to testify on the various parts of the Health Care Access Commission report. The two reports, the Health Care Access Commission, which is a legislative body, and the Transformation Task Force that the two commissioners just discussed were independent, but the results were very similar, so there's a great deal of similarity in the two reports. I want to thank all these people that have signed up to talk, especially after we ruined their summer and fall. We had 65 official meetings of various work groups, and the overall committee, there was at least 105 people that participated in these discussions, and countless hours were spent by these people preparing their testimony and showing up at these meetings. And if you look at the people that are lined up to testify today, you'll see there's a broad range from labor, Chamber of Commerce, business, healthcare plans, providers. Everybody was involved in a very open process. I want to warn you, however, that everything in this report is controversial. There's nothing in it that everybody will support and say this is the greatest thing and agree on it. Anytime you want to change a system, it's going to be uncomfortable to a lot of people. And these two reports do look at changing our healthcare system, or lack thereof. I'll give you a couple of quotes. One is Dr. Jordy Cohen, who was head of the American Association of Medical Colleges for a number of years. He said a couple of years ago that he wished people would quit saying that the American healthcare system was broken, because if you say it's broken, that implies that you can fix it. And he prefers the word obsolete. And I've handed out a quote there from George Halverson. Obviously, this is a guy who knows. He used to be head of Health Partners, and now he is head of Kaiser Permanente. And he said, "We don't really have a healthcare delivery system in this country. We have an expensive plethora of uncoordinated, unlinked, economically segregated, operationally limited microsystems, each performing in ways that too often create suboptimal performance, both for the overall healthcare infrastructure and for individual patients." Those two quotes say that we need some drastic changes in our healthcare system, and this report recommends that. And with that, I think I'll just turn it over to the people that are going to testify.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. We'll get started. Dr. Reed, and I think Representative Norton is on her way. So, Dr. Reed, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Maureen Reed. I'm a physician and a member of the Transformation Task Force, and it is an honor to be with you here this afternoon and talk about this particular report. Parenthetically, I would say I'm very envious of the task that you all have in front of you. because 2008 could be, should be the year that Minnesota puts the big fix in place for health care. And so it is with great anticipation that those of us who have been on the various task forces look to this next phase of the action that you are undertaking here. It's my task to speak with about the first of five recommendations that the Transformation Task Force has made. This is the first principle is sometimes called the public health principle. It is about health, and it is has remarkable similarities to the Legislative Commission Working Group, which Representative Norton will be speaking about a few minutes from now. I think it tells you something when there is a lot of alignment between two different groups who are looking at the very same subject, which is health and how do we all in Minnesota get healthier. So the Transformation Task Force actually did four things. It set goals. It identified the items that are killing us in Minnesota. It said that for those big killers, we need to recommend a course of action. And the course of action that was recommended by the Transformation Task Force has two parts. The community or population aspect of action, and then the individual aspect of action. And finally, the Transformation Task Force identifying calculated the dollar savings and the investment that would be required in order to accomplish the goals in the time frame that was laid out. So, what are the goals? First of all, there's a goal with regard to obesity. No surprise to anyone in this room, only 37% of Minnesotans, slightly over a third of Minnesotans, are at a healthy weight. Transformation Task Force says we need to get that to 50% of Minnesotans by 2020. And this is a very aggressive objective, a very aggressive goal to make those kinds of inroads into this particular condition. The second task, the second area that the task force looked at was tobacco. Tobacco is still the number one killer of Minnesotans. It will be for another few years until, sadly, obesity overtakes that particular dubious distinction of being in the lead. And what the task force set in terms of a goal for tobacco was to cut in half the number of smokers in Minnesota. Currently, about 18% of Minnesotans smoke, and we have recommended that in a few years this should drop to less than 9%. Another goal was set in the area of binge drinking. It blows my mind, 30% of our 12th graders are binge drinkers. And we have set forth some recommendations for reducing the incidence of binge drinking in the population in Minnesota. And we've also set some recommendations for reducing the use of illicit drugs. So those are the four areas that we have targeted, and we have targeted them because they are the big killers and the big causes of misery for people in our state. So, what are the actions that we have recommended? First of all, we recommend widespread adoption of these specific goals. When we have a lot of different goals floating out there, we don't have much consensus about exactly how to get things done. So we say, with these goals, let's adopt them statewide. Secondly, we took in our task force a very hard look at the Minnesota, the statewide health improvement comprehensive plan. We took a hard look at it, and we recommend that it be put in place and that it be funded. We believe that it does the things that are important to get Minnesota healthier. And what does it do? It sets statewide accountability. It applies to communities the task of accepting their responsibility for their aspect of the health situation in Minnesota. And then it supports the efforts of those communities. It is not particularly prescriptive, but it is directional and it is encouraging. In terms of communities, it also takes a special look at schools, because, of course, obesity is epidemic among our children, and so It asks that the schools take a particular role with regard to healthy food, healthy eating, and activity. And the statewide report also recommends that we get after tobacco by doing three things. Stronger enforcement of youth access. Secondly, re-energizing the counter marketing program in order to target childhood tobacco use and to change the views of children with regard to tobacco. And third, to increase the tobacco impact fee. So those are the things that are recommended within that particular report, and we have forwarded those as recommendations of our task force. We have also said that there should be public reporting, very in-your-face public reporting of how we are doing as a state with regard to these particular things. And we have targeted individual actions as well. We believe that health policies, health insurance policies sold here in Minnesota should not have barriers to preventive services, that all preventive services should be covered with no copay. And we also have recommended that there be differential individual premiums for individuals that do not smoke and keep their weight at a healthy level. When we take a look at all of those recommendations, we have come up with the savings that are a net of $1.3 billion in savings in 2011 and $3.25 billion of savings by 2015. And I make a note of those that we talk about billions of dollars and we sort of lose track of what that means. But this is not as much about dollar savings as it is savings of misery. Because a high savings rate in terms of dollars translates into huge savings in terms of Minnesotans' misery. And that is, in short, the report of our first recommendation on health. And Representative Norton will talk about the legislative working group's recommendation.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there is a great deal of similarity between these two plans, and so I'll try to just touch on some things that might be a little bit different. One, the Healthcare Access Commission did form a subcommittee on public health. That committee met numerous times over the summer and fall to come up with the recommendations. Steve Gottwall, Representative Gottwall, is he in the room?
You just stepped up some.
Okay. Was one of the co-chairs of that committee, as was Senator Patricia Torres-Ray. And they did a wonderful job bringing together many, many stakeholders. It was quite a long list of stakeholders and just a couple legislators. So it was lots of folks from in the field that spent many hours discussing this. The Public Health Working Group chose to focus its recommendations on ways to reduce the prevalence of chronic conditions in Minnesota. We chose to emphasize primary prevention methods by focusing on programs that encouraged and empowered people to make healthy lifestyle choices. Additionally, the working group advises implementing policies to reduce the incidence of childhood obesity will further reduce the incidence of costly chronic diseases associated with overweight and obesity among children. And you heard some of those similar comments from Dr. Reed. I think I will start out by mentioning the Public Health Work Group, when it made its recommendations, spent quite a bit of time talking about how best to make an impact so that we can have the cost savings through prevention. And we talked about school-based interventions as well as community-based interventions. And so to that end, the recommendations that we came forward and that were that are Healthcare Access Commission recommendations are that we implement and fund the Comprehensive Health Promotion Program developed by the Minnesota Department of Health, and I believe it's currently being called SHIP, to promote partnerships among local communities, schools, workplaces, and healthcare providers to address prevention of chronic conditions statewide. And further, it says the health of Minnesotans must be significantly improved, and all major organizations in the state should accept responsibility for helping achieve aggressive health improvement goals. And I think it might be mentioned that in our committee, this is our first recommendation, and one of the reasons for that is because it was comprehensive and it did reach beyond the schools and went and included all stakeholders, and that we feel in order to have the outcomes that we want to achieve, that has to happen. So you will see that our second and third recommendations The second one is to adopt statewide curriculum standards for health, nutrition, and physical education. The committee, the Public Health Committee, did not make a specific, did not direct specific legislation, but it instead made some kind of guidelines towards that, and I noticed the Healthcare Commission kind of fleshed those out a little bit further than the Public Health Subcommittee's recommendations. And that that we established graduation requirements for Minnesota schools. The standards would include 30 minutes of activity per day, of which 90 minutes per week must be cardiovascular in nature. The state must provide funding to the schools to implement these standards. And I would mention in our subcommittee, we did spend a lot of time about worrying about unfunded mandates, and so that was one of the reasons we did not bring forward a very specific recommendation about a particular level of activity, and talked a lot about activity as opposed to physical education and some of those nuances. And then the last recommendation was to require the Department of Health in consultation with the Department of Education to use existing systems to monitor childhood obesity by using body mass index, BMI, measures, and to report that to the legislature by 2009. And the BMI discussion was also one of worrying about unfunded mandates. How are we going to accomplish this? The subcommittee discussion was very much involving physicians and other providers in the community to help with that, although I noticed the recommendation talked quite a bit more specific to schools, and we did believe there was a role for schools, excuse me, but that the full responsibility maybe didn't need to lie with the schools, that we could ask physicians as part of perhaps physician standards in the future to include BMI, and that the state could help us make recommendations as to how to gather that information and move forward. So just quickly, if that's what you're looking for, that's an overview of the three recommendations. There is a great deal of similarity between the two. I think our committee did not go quite as far as the Transformational Task Force in including alcohol. We kind of stopped short of that. And I think one of the concerns from the Public Health Subcommittee's group was that we not lose the focus on public health and childhood obesity in spreading ourselves too thin and perhaps losing our emphasis in order. We want to gain the results of the prevention, gain the cost savings results. And so we did talk a little bit about worrying about losing focus. So I'd add that.
Questions to the testifying members? I did have one question. If you could just, in terms of setting some of the targets and the cost savings, could you talk a little bit about underlying the research that supports that's based on, that there was some underlying work done that kind of matched up cost savings with improvements in obesity and tobacco rates, etc.?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This Transformation Task Force looked very hard at the evidence for things that work with regard to obesity, tobacco, alcohol, and we did a lot of investigation of the kinds of actions out there that actually have a track record of success. So the Department of Health also provided us with extensive information from other states nationally as to the kinds of things that work. And we have fair confidence that if the investments are made in the public health aspect of this recommendation, that we can in fact get the savings out. Was there something more specific that you wanted, Mr. Chair?
No, thank you. That's helpful. All right. Well, thank you for making the presentation. We really appreciate it. And this really is such an important piece of this whole puzzle, I think. So thanks to both of you for coming down and the work you did this year on it. The next testifier is Mr. Seid and Ms. Schnell. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And you know the drill, I think.
Mr. Chairman and members, I am Elliot Side. I'm the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 workers throughout Minnesota, including state, county, municipal, school district, university, hospital, and long-term care workers. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to talk with you today about the need for affordable health care. And we believe that we can have better care at a lower cost. Affordability, Mr. Chairman and members, is the issue. This past weekend, we brought together 300 AFSCME local leaders and members from across the state for a conference on affordable health care. Those assembled strongly endorsed and will carry forth our message that health care must be affordable. When it comes to health care, our members are a microcosm of Minnesota. 93% of AFSCME members have health insurance, and 92% of Minnesotans have health insurance. The average AFSCME member earns $36,000 a year, and the average Minnesotan earns $38,000 a year. 3,000 of our members are uninsured, and 374,000 Minnesotans are uninsured. 1.1 million Minnesotans can expect to pay more than 10% of their income on health care in 2008. Most surprisingly, 9 out of 10 of them have insurance. Here are some examples of AFSCME members who lack affordable health care. A Hennepin County worker, and these are real examples, pays $335 per month for family coverage and spends $11,000 per year on premiums and out-of-pocket costs for medical and dental care. A part-time librarian with Washington County is working for health care. Her check is only $24 after she pays for family coverage. A mother working for a nonprofit employer is underinsured and can't afford family coverage. She has minimal insurance for herself, but can't afford the $529 it would cost to cover her family. High copays prevent her from getting preventative care and taking the medicine she needs. Her family nearly lost their home to pay for cancer treatment for her uninsured husband. A child care provider is self-employed with no benefits. She earns too much to qualify for Minnesota care and can't afford a private plan. When a child is sick, she can't afford to take him to the doctor unless it's absolutely necessary. A catastrophic illness would bankrupt her family. We all know that cost is the problem. The average annual premium for family coverage is now more than $12,000. The cost has almost doubled since 2000. Wages have not kept pace with the rising cost of health benefits. Real wages have largely remained static for the last 20 years. We need affordable health care, which we define as meaning that no one should pay more than 5% of their income on health care. We call that the 5% solution. That means that the average Minnesotan who earns $38,000 a year should pay no more than $1,900 per year in out-of-pocket costs for health care. Every Minnesotan and every American deserves guaranteed affordable health insurance with a choice of private or public plans that cover all necessary medical services paid for by payroll taxes on employers and individuals on a sliding scale. We believe, Mr. Chairman, and this is off the written testimony you have, that reform should define affordability by determining what families and individuals can afford to pay at different income levels. Reform should contain costs by setting and forcing limits on growth in health care costs. Reform should create transparency on costs and quality. We should define quality and define tools of change, then allow competition on who can best execute the changes. Reform should offer patients incentives, not punishment. Create fair, effective incentives for patients to make healthy decisions and use the healthcare system wisely. Reform should empower consumers, not suppliers. Today, our healthcare system is shaped by suppliers who are motivated by profits. It should be shaped by consumers who are motivated to be healthy. Reform should reform the payment system. And here in Minnesota, we could use the state employee group health insurance for pilot projects to reform the payment system to reward better health, better quality, better access, and greater efficiency. To drive down costs, we need to promote early intervention for chronic diseases. It's less expensive to help a diabetic control his blood sugars than to amputate his foot. We need to avoid unnecessary procedures. Doctors don't need to use expensive technology just because their hospital invested in it. For example, there should be a protocol for which medical conditions require MRIs and other diagnostic imaging. And by the way, we ought to ask ourselves why MRIs cost $1,000 in one part of the state and $5,000 in another part of the state. We need to align medical facility investments with consumer needs. For example, build hospitals only where they're needed, put in one children's hospital instead of three, share expensive diagnostic imaging technology, and other instances of that nature. Mr. Chairman and members, we need to eliminate administrative waste. If you want efficiency, look to Medicare for administrative costs of only 3%. Compare that to for-profit HMOs, for-profit, not our nonprofit, up to 26%. This shows that government can do it better and less expensively, and many times, than the private sector. The healthcare plans that our members are in have administrative costs of 6 to 10%. That's still much more than Medicare. And we can also deal with some outrageous CEO salaries. We had United Healthcare's Bill McGuire. We don't see why somebody should be making those kind of profits while people are going without healthcare. Mr. Chairman and members, we believe we can get to affordability by establishing that the state of Minnesota will ensure that every resident will have affordable care. We define it affordable as a 5% solution. We need to develop ways to allow people to enroll in Minnesota Care or a similar program if they cannot otherwise get affordable care. And we need to develop ways to subsidize the employee share premiums and keep employer money in health care. The members of the Affordable Health Care for All Coalition, which includes Aspen Council 5, my sisters and brothers at SEIU Minnesota State Council, the Minnesota Nurses Association, which is here today in great force, the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota, Education Minnesota, Isaiah, the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and Take Action Minnesota, are all working together on the 5% solution and other items. We thank you for acknowledging the wisdom of an affordability standard. The Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access proposes an affordability standard of 6% of household income at 300% of poverty and 8% of income at 400% of poverty. The Governor's Transformation Task Force suggests 7% at 300% of poverty and 10% at 400% of poverty. You are looking at ways to fund the right health care for ways to remove the barriers to care. Let's keep moving towards the 5% affordability standard. As we pointed out, health care is now unaffordable for many. So let's invest in health care and make it affordable for the people who work so hard yet can't afford the care. And Mr. Chairman, with your permission, throw along some cards. We had this conference of 300 people. We've been doing lots of work on this. Our last issue of the paper had major page on affordability. We've had editorials on it. This goes out to 43,000 people. And we have these cards we'd like to share with the committee on affordability and a little laminated card, if that's all right, with the chairman.
Well, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. And Ms. Schnell, please go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Schnell, and I'm president of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent 14,000 healthcare workers across the state of Minnesota. I'm today going to speak more about opportunity and the member perspective than I am going to suggest that there is an outright solution to the crisis in healthcare. Yesterday, I had the privilege of standing alongside Billy Edmonds, who is one of four SEIU members featured in the handout that you are receiving. Representative Thiessen joined me and Billy and hundreds of SEIU members and community activists on a picket line as SEIU security officers were on strike over the lack of affordable health care coverage. And recently, I again had the privilege to stand with SEIU members from Health Partners as they voted to go on strike in order to guarantee safe staffing standards in their workplace and affordable health care coverage. I cannot tell you what courage it takes for a worker to take a strike vote, let alone to go out on strike. When you live paycheck to paycheck, which many of our members do, the idea of not getting paid is scary. But when faced with not being able to afford health care coverage for your family, people find the courage to stand up and demand change. SEIU members have the courage to go out on strike for affordable health care. Community activists and people of faith connected to IDEA have the courage to work with us and others to build a grassroots movement to demand affordable health care. And SEIU members that are part of delivering health care have the courage to accept change in their jobs if it means real reform in the health care system. I come here today to urge you to also have the courage. Please have the political courage necessary to make the real changes needed for all of us to have access to high-quality, affordable health care.
We've compared your proposals of an affordability standard, improved access, and payment reform to our principles on health care reform. We laud you for your efforts, but we urge you to have the courage to go further. Obviously, a standard that people should pay no more than 6% of their income on health care would help our members, who, as you can see from the flyer, pay anywhere from 16 to 28% of their income for health care insurance. However, we hope that you will find the courage to go further. An affordability standard placed on the current system is based on the assumption that you can control costs in the system. If you don't control those costs, the government will then be subsidizing ever-increasing insurance premiums. We need to go further to change the current system. We think the payment reform proposals, including what people call payment reform level 3, is a good first step in reforming the current system. With level 3, financial incentives are not based on volume of health care, but rather quality of health care. We support that proposal, but again, urge you to go further. Tweaking the current system gets us closer, but it clearly does not achieve the reform necessary to really make health care affordable for all of us. SEIU members have the courage to stand up to employers and take the risks necessary to fight for affordable health care. And I urge you to have the courage to stand up to those that will tell you that the status quo works and fight for a system that truly provides health care, affordable health care, quality affordable health care for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go on, I do have to announce that the fire folks are telling us we have to clear the aisles. And so there is audio in the basement hearing room. So if you could please help us out with that, that would be great. Thank you. Did any members have any questions? Representative Godwell. We have a few questions, if that's okay. Representative Godwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and testifiers, in light of the fact that the primary driver of health care costs, we've got aging baby boomers moving into their top chronic disease utilization years, so it's rather disassociated from usual inflation. When we set arbitrary limits like 5%, who pays the difference? Because there's going to be a big difference. Who pays for that?
Mr. Pitt.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that some of the things that were suggested in the Health Care Transformation Task Force that Commissioner Ludeman put forth on payment reform, if we get more people into preventative care and get the payment system right to pay out so people can get preventative care, we're not only going to get healthier outcomes, Mr. Chairman and members, we're going to get better fiscal controls in the system. And part of the problem now is that people who need to get in early, you can deal with diabetes ahead of time. You can know that someone's going to get diabetes, that someone's getting in to get preventative care. If they're not getting that, if they can't afford to get to the doctor, Mr. Chairman and members, and then end up in the emergency room, and then end up in the hospital, that only makes the person less healthier. It costs the system more. I don't have a single answer to your question. I just think there needs to be, and AFSCME thinks there needs to be, an affordability standard. That we do this in housing and income. We say, well, if you're going to have a decent life, you shouldn't have to spend more than 25% to 30% on your housing. And it's the same thing on health care. Except in the case of health care, not only does it produce healthier outcomes, it produces better fiscal controls if members have access, if citizens have access to health care at a preventative level. It's fiscally prudent, and it's better for the health of our citizens.
Mr. Chair, well, thanks to the testifiers, the one who chaired our public health working group on the Health Care Access Commission, I can tell you I'm well aware of the importance of preventive care and putting more money up front. But even though we set a standard for housing, we don't necessarily subsidize everybody to that standard. And that's my concern is these health care cost increases we're talking about are going to continue to drive the system up. And there are many things we can do and should be doing to try to control that. But setting an arbitrary 5% in place implies subsidy of a significant amount from somebody else.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I think the greatest middle-class program in America, Mr. Chairman and members, is that mortgage interest subsidy program of the federal government. I mean, after all, people get to write on their taxes, work on their taxes. Anyone owns a home knows that you get to basically cover a bit of your mortgage costs based on your taxable rate through the federal government. It's the biggest middle-income, middle-class program in the country. So I think if we can do that for housing, we can certainly find a way to do something for health care.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Aaron Sexton and Beth Hartwig, please. Thanks a lot for coming today. Welcome to the committee. Another side of affordability.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Hartwig, and I represent Minnesota Business Partnership. Our members are the chief executives of Minnesota's largest employers. They employ 400,000 Minnesotans and nearly 2 million people worldwide. It's a pleasure to be in front of both committees here jointly. I wonder if you've heard this one before. Guy walks into the doctor's office and says, "Doc, it hurts when I go like this." The doctor says, "Don't do that." It's an old joke, but sound advice. As we talk about transforming our healthcare system, our obsolete or broken healthcare system, into a functioning marketplace. I was a little nervous about that joke delivery. Not very good.
It was good. Wow. Yes.
Across the country and in Minnesota, we do a lot of things that we know aren't working in healthcare. We've got to stop doing what we know hurts us and start looking for a better way of doing things. Minnesota's long been considered a leader in overall healthcare coverage and services. I won't repeat the numbers that you all know so well. However, the rapid increases in cost of care can stunt wage growth and job creation. Minnesota's not alone in facing these pressures. Those states that enact structural reforms which successfully engage individuals in decisions that improve overall health, control costs, and improve the quality of care will be at a competitive advantage. We want to be that state. With that in mind, the partnership embraces principles for value-based competition. We want to realign the incentives for all stakeholders to move towards a more competitive model. This year, the partnership and the Minnesota Chamber jointly adopted a new plan for healthcare reform. The goal of our plan is simple: to ensure a functioning and responsive healthcare marketplace that will achieve optimal health outcomes, reduce the cost of healthcare, reduce the rate of future cost increases, and increase access to affordable healthcare for all Minnesotans. With perhaps the exception of the word marketplace, I think everyone at this table can agree with that goal. But defining the change that is necessary to achieve that goal is difficult. So we were quite pleased this past summer and fall throughout all of the meetings to have so many groups talking about market-based reform. I'll focus today on a couple of affordability recommendations from the task force report. Since the feds aren't likely to act soon to reform IRS policies, we need to find a way to allow individuals to purchase health care with pre-tax dollars and to give those same individuals a way to continue their chosen health care as they move from job to job or from one stage of life to the next. So we're intrigued with the potential of the health insurance exchange, but realize there are many details to work out. Aaron will be addressing that a little bit in a little while. We need to make it easier for individuals to be savvy healthcare consumers. People get this stuff. They are interested in the quality of their care, and they understand that they have a role in controlling costs. But we need to make it easier for them. We have to help them find ways to compare coverage products and buy what makes the most sense for themselves and their families. Help them make those good decisions. The task force calls for creating a model that will allow for easier comparison and that will simplify the system for everyone. And the partnership certainly supports helping those most in need. That is what the government is here for. But we want to see those people using their subsidies in the same marketplace as everyone else, where there's competition for those dollars and where they'll get the same high-value care that we're getting in the private sector. You've heard it before, but I'll say it again because it's so basic. Health insurance is expensive because health care is expensive. Large employers have great flexibility in the health benefits that they extend to their employees. They've been looking for unique ways to control costs for decades. Some are more successful and more popular than others. Here are a couple that line up with the task force recommendations. Improve health. We must reduce the rates of obesity, tobacco use, the use of alcohol and other drugs, among many other public health issues. Employers across Minnesota and the country are enacting employee wellness programs to ensure that their workforce remains healthy and productive. But it goes further than that. They're also giving to their employees' families, and this is a benefit for our communities as a whole. Measure cost and quality. There are a number of ways employers are trying to enhance the value of their care that their employees receive, but it's also measuring it. But it's not just measuring it, but also driving improvement through the methods, such as pay for performance. While some argue measuring procedures for pay for performance is not the ideal way to achieve improvement, it was one method that employers thought that they could do on their own and achieve some savings. But we certainly open to other ways of measuring and improving quality. Bottom line is that we in the business community are ready for the difficult discussions. We may not like everything that comes forth, all the proposals that come forth this session, but we are excited to hear the discussions being based around patient-centered, market-based principles. Thank you.
Ms. Sexton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Erin Sexton. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber appreciates the work and effort that the members of the Governor's Transformation Task Force and the Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access have put into the reports that have both been put forward. Addressing the problems in our current healthcare system, specifically the high cost of healthcare, is a huge priority for our members. Frankly, our members just simply can't afford the status quo. The Minnesota Chamber supports options that will help businesses and individuals obtain affordable health insurance coverage in the private market, and I would like to specifically address support for the concept of the health insurance exchange. We believe that the proposed health insurance exchange will provide a mechanism for employers to help their employees obtain coverage in the private market by allowing them to purchase individual health insurance plans using pre-tax dollars. This could represent significant savings for individuals purchasing health care insurance, while at the same time allowing the individual employee to choose a plan that fits their lifestyle, age, whatever it might be the best. It also provides an opportunity for employers to contribute a defined amount for their employees to use to purchase health insurance. For small employers who are unable to absorb the significant increase in their premiums each year, this allows them to budget and determine what they can afford and contribute to that employee's health insurance plan. This concept provides an opportunity for small employers who are currently not offering health insurance benefits or who are struggling to continue to offer this benefit to their employees to obtain more affordable coverage and to help their employees then obtain more affordable coverage in the individual market. We believe that the benefits of the health insurance exchange, has the potential to provide going forward will drive small employers to participate on a voluntary basis. Thus, I don't necessarily see the need to have a mandate to purchase the Section 125 plans, because I think they will see the benefits that this provides for both them and their employees. So the Minnesota Chamber does support this concept, and we look forward to working with you to bring this to fruition and hopefully make this a tool that will help our employers and employees navigate this health insurance market. We think it will help make health insurance more affordable, create ease, efficiency, and options in the individual market. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope as we have this discussion and this idea of buying health care with pre-tax dollars comes up again, that somebody will be able to give us a dollar amount of what that might cost the state.
Representative Shumper, I think we actually know that number.
Oh, we do.
Yes. Not off the top of our head, but we have a fiscal note on it. So it's in the range of $6 or $8 million. Is that?
That's all?
Yeah.
Really?
The federal government pays a lot more, but the state government has a small amount. But we'll get to that number. There's a fiscal note on it.
And I think, Mr. Chair, on that point, I think it is that the state, you could grant, you know, you could allow Minnesotans right now to do pre-tax dollars on the state piece, but it is the federal piece that is much more significant and meaningful, and this health insurance exchange helps set up a mechanism for individuals to access the federal pre-tax benefits.
It was, Mr. Chair, on the order of, I don't know, 5 to 10 million, but you need to also understand that there's that would be a loss to the state treasury. But for every dollar that we would lose in our state treasury, Minnesotans would save $4 in federal taxes. So it's in terms of the state economy overall, it's a big benefit.
President Gumbel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sexton, I'm wondering, you know, are there other ways of applying pre-tax dollars without using the exchange? And the reason I ask is there have been some concerns about the exchange kind of destroying what we currently have in the way of private sector distribution and relationships with insurance. Can you give me some comfort with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, we have not seen another mechanism that would work to help these, you know, individuals access the pre-tax benefit that employees now, employed individuals have access to. You know, I think we're obviously going to have to work together to make sure this is done in the best way. I think there have been some steps compared to the legislation we had last year to what the task force was looking at that would allow products to be sold both inside and outside the exchange. And so I think there have been some mechanisms to make sure that your concerns would be addressed. But we obviously share those, and we'll work with you to make sure that we all have comfort there.
Thank you for coming today. We really appreciate it. Now we're going to talk about the health care home part of the report. Representative Murphy and Drs. Wood and Rank, you want to come on up? Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. I'm delighted to be here today to talk with you a little bit about the concept of the healthcare home, and I want to begin by thanking the many members who are in the room today who served on our working group this summer and fall and into the winter. We had a really remarkable run, and I think the fruit of our work is a model that promises not only better care, which is very important to me, it also will yield better health for those with chronic conditions and all of that for a better price. And that's a pretty good deal, I think, when we think about health care and health care reform. Data and anecdote will tell us that there's a lot of money in health care, but we're not really spending enough of it on care. And I am happy that Dr. Brian Rank and Dr. Doug Wood are here today to talk with you a little bit more about the concept of a medical home. We talk about it as a healthcare home in the legislature and in the working group. The concept originated as a patient-centered medical home, and they're going to go through that presentation today using that terminology. And hopefully we will not get caught up in the titles. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. I am Dr. Doug Wood. I'm Vice Chair of the Department of Medicine at Mayo, and it was a privilege to serve on the cost containment Identify Healthcare Savings Work Group that was led by Representative Murphy and Senator Lurie. Dr. Rank and I are going to try to explain this concept to you today, so as we go along, he and I will go back and forth, and hopefully we'll leave you with a much better understanding of something that will actually achieve many of the goals that those that have preceded us in testimony today have actually talked about in rather general terms. So any opening comments, Brian?
Dr. Wood is the extrovert of us two, so he's going to take the most part of the presentation, and I'll grab some comments at the end.
So we've heard already today about the concern of affordability, and it has been emphasized that we need to find ways to reduce costs. We intend to share with you the benefits of medical homes and how we think this approach to care will achieve these goals. Now, the concept is defined, as Representative Murphy mentioned, perhaps could have a better name. Medical home may not be the best description. It conjures up some other images. Certainly, it conjures up often an image of a physical structure, which it is not. It is really a system of care that is intended to change the way that we deliver care to address some major shortcomings in health care today. Now, Representative Huntley, in his opening comments, used a very good quote by George Halverson. And so let me take you back to that and think about changing from lots of individual little units that are focused on themselves to a larger unit or team that is focused on not themselves and their own economic efficiency, but on the health of a patient. And the lack of coordination of care coupled with current payment systems that force you to think about what you can do to generate your own economic health, that is, what is a billable service, are two of the probably greatest contributors to the problems that we have today. This also tends to promote the overutilization of procedures, especially interventional procedures that may not have much proven benefit but have lots of proven costs, and an underuse of things that don't have a lot of proven costs but have lots of proven but as yet unappreciated benefit. So coming back to the medical home, this is not a structure, but rather it is an approach to patients with a system of support for the physician. And it's important to recognize that we're moving beyond just a physician. We're moving to team-based care that is longitudinal and carries over time. This capability of carrying over time is what creates a substantial capability of delivering much more efficient care and understands how patients, in fact, might be partners in that activity. Now, the concept of a patient-centered medical home has now been endorsed by the four largest specialty societies in the United States that certify physicians who provide much of the country's primary care: the American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Association of Osteopathic Physicians. Last year agreed on a set of joint principles. The major principles are summarized on this slide. It's important to recognize that this is not intended to be specialty specific. In fact, any provider or physician might assume the role of medical home, assuming they understand what goes into the concept of coordinated care. So this is not specific to a specific individual type of training or life. Now, it's also important to recognize that if we do this right, we should make it clear that the choice of an individual, that is, a buyer, to use a medical home should be voluntary and based on an ability to achieve those things that he or she would like in healthcare. The choice of a provider to participate should also be voluntary, that is, those physicians who are most capable and most interested in providing this kind of care would then find this attractive with the payment reforms that would go along with it. Now, this graphic representation is important. Don't worry about the small print around the edges. What this represents is a patient that is cared for by a team of providers. Right now, most care is compensated on a fee-for-service basis, and it's dependent on physician billing. Around the state, those organizations that have tried to deal with chronic disease and getting away from physician-based billing have found it very difficult to provide the kind of care they would like to do. That coordination of care simply is not recognized or rewarded with our current payment structure. This approach allows us then to have individuals work up to the level of their license, extend their capability, and if you think about the prospects of physician shortages that have been posed by some observers, and recognize that an individual physician might care for 2,000 patients, but a well-functioning team might be able to care for 3,000, 4,000, or even 5,000 patients, it is not too hard to imagine that we would be able to get through the demands of the growing patient population, especially the baby boomers, and their demands of chronic care that confront us, and do so in a much more efficient fashion. Now, there are some people who might think that we already have medical homes, but if you can identify a doctor, you have a medical home. As we go through this discussion, I hope you'll be able to understand that simply having a regular source of care does not mean you have a medical home. This is information that was provided in a survey from the Commonwealth Foundation earlier in 2007. And the Commonwealth Foundation surveyed adults 18 to 64 who asked if they could get care when they needed it to meet their particular needs. And when looking at the number of adults who could describe their practice in a way that met the concept of medical home, they were much more likely to be able to get access to care than those patients who reported having simply a regular physician or who went to the emergency room or had no regular source of care. So the point here is that being a medical home is much more than simply being a regular physician or a regular provider of care. We have already experience in this state that in fact convinces us that there is great potential in this approach. At St. Mary's Duluth Clinic and their chronic disease management program for heart failure, at Park Nicollet with the CMS demonstration on heart failure care, the Health Partners Diabetes Care Disease Management Program, have been really stellar examples about what healthcare really could be if we could liberate ourselves from the tyranny of the visit that is embodied in the current payment system of volume, not value. If you look at medical homes in the state and ask what makes them different, if you go to those practices, you can see that patients have care plans developed more of the time. With care plans developed, they achieve better outcomes. And costs, in fact, are reduced because resource utilization is more appropriate. There are more appropriate outpatient visits, but there are fewer hospital admissions and fewer hospital days, and the use of drugs is much more appropriate, all of which are significant drivers of care. We can also show that there's an improvement in the quality of care, especially in chronic care. When you look at team-based primary care delivery, it is less expensive than an uncoordinated specialty care visit. I could not describe it any more eloquently than George Halverson did in the way that it was shared with us by Representative Huntley. And if we can find a way that we can link the appropriate incentives for patients to work with their providers, we think there's even greater potential in this concept of medical home. Now, this graph represents the cost structure of disease. 70-80% of costs are consumed by 20-30% of our patients. And those costs come in expensive care locations like the hospital. In the ambulatory setting, effective care, meaning preventive services, are delivered only about half the time. Beth McGlynn and her colleagues at the RAND Corporation completed a survey of this capability in the United States 2 years ago. Unfortunately, we're all too willing to pay for hospital care. We simply don't pay very much for outpatient care. Co-pays and exclusions, high deductibles, don't seem to make much sense when, in fact, you're trying to emphasize an approach that is based on non-hospital care, and in fact could be based on non-office-based care, with care at home, in the schools, or at work. Here's another interesting slide. We've heard today already about the cost of technology and the opportunities of prevention. Dr. Tom Kotke is a preventive cardiologist who was previously a colleague of mine at Mayo Clinic, but now works at Health Partners. And Tom's analysis shows the lives saved for 100,000 population aged 10 to 84 in a steady-state system. Now, starting at the bottom of this slide and working up, rescue angioplasty, that is, the dramatic performance of a heart catheterization and angioplasty of a blood vessel in a patient who is having a heart attack, may save 15 lives per 100,000 people. That kind of care is compensated heavily and requires hospital utilization, which is also costly. On the other hand, a provider, either a cardiologist interested in preventive cardiology or a primary care physician, who might practice lifestyle and risk factor control among apparently healthy individuals, can save far more lives, 200 compared to the 15 per 1,000. So will be paid far less for that entire effort than his interventional colleagues will be paid for the small number of angioplasties that he or she might provide. So this is another example of the paradox that exists in our current delivery and payment system. Now, there is much written about how the reimbursement model for a patient-centered medical home might work, so we want to leave you with a conceptual framework. In this circumstance, the concept is that you will make a payment for a qualified medical home to cover services that are not normally reimbursed, that are care coordination services. That payment is made on the basis of a person and could be on the basis of a person per month, but it is to recognize those coordination services and the overhead necessary to produce those that are not now recognized in payment for a visit. There would continue to be a fee schedule for visits and procedures, and then overlaid on top of that could be appropriate incentives for pay-for-performance, either achieving quality outcomes or resource utilization and patient experience outcomes. All might be used. Think about what the emphasis, what we might do if we would change the emphasis to how many hospital days did you avoid as a medical home, as opposed to how many hospital days did you bill? Significantly different set of incentives. So why make the changes? We need to make these changes in order to ensure affordability as well as effective and efficient health care for Minnesotans. We think the medical home gives us the greatest potential to make that happen. It is not possible to articulate a simple cure for smoking or obesity as has been described today, But having a highly functioning team that has incorporated the patient as part of that team, we believe gives us the greatest promise in achieving these long-term behavioral goals. Without payment reform, we will lose the primary care base that we have developed in Minnesota. When you look at measures of quality of a healthcare system, Minnesota consistently ranks at the top because we have been able to sustain a large number of primary care physicians per capita. But in a minute, I'll show you some disturbing information that suggests we might, in fact, be losing that. We also would suggest that the payments for medical home cannot be solely additive, so we must be able to expect some results for what we want to accomplish. This graph shows the number of family medicine physicians offered in the United States, which is the top dark line, and the number of physicians that have been accepted by U.S. graduating medical seniors, which is in the bottom red line. What is probably more important about this is that if you think about the long time to when these physicians would practice and think about the demands that are coming at us, it would take us a long time to have enough providers if we simply wanted to go back and do things the way we've been doing them. Instead, if we convert to a different approach, physician-directed medical homes where there are multiple providers, we could take care of a lot more patients per team and indeed improve the efficiency of our delivery system. That would, in remarkable ways, address a shortage that has been described by many people, and at the same time achieve, again, our goals of affordability and accessibility for care. We believe, in summary, that care in medical homes is more accessible, it is more effective. In medical homes, care coordination is better, resource utilization is better, more preventive care is delivered. And those who have preceded us today have emphasized again that these are high-level goals. And we are hoping to convince you that the medical home, in its concept, maybe not the exact name, but in the concept of coordination of care and patient-centered care, gives us the best hope of achieving all of the goals that have been shared with you today. So with that, we will stop, and at the discretion of the chair, any other comments? Brian, do you want to say anything else?
Thanks. A couple of comments to support what Dr. Wood has said. Supporting a medical home makes good sense for Minnesota, both for patients to strengthen the primary care system that's threatened today. I liken the medical home to a trusted guide through a potentially dangerous and very expensive foreign land. That my patients, I'm an oncologist, Dr. Wood is a cardiologist, but when my patients come to me, they are looking for support and for what is the best care that can help me, and how do you keep me out of trouble for doing the things that could potentially harm me. And so reliably building the processes, the systems, and the technology to reliably deliver the right care at the right time for the right patient for the least cost is our holy grail. And we believe that the medical home, the patient-centered medical home, is our way to accomplish that. It's more, as Dr. Wood says, it's more than an assigned clinic for care coordination. It's about care teams working in new ways to support patients, using available technology and improving technology over time to integrate disease management, care management into clinical care. It supports what the Institute of Healthcare Improvement calls the triple aim of care that is that maximizes the health of populations, the experience of individuals, and affordability. Healthcare providers need healthcare home is not nebulous. There are national standards for what we would consider a medical home. I tend to think about the National Council on Quality Assurance, and that's worked a lot on this and what those requirements would be, and at what level payment would be for becoming a medical home. And it's not just declaring myself a medical home, as that slide that from the Commonwealth Foundation that Dr. Wood showed. We should build on national models rather than recreating something ourselves. We should be careful to avoid mandating extra care coordination payments without meeting those criteria, as this will add cost to the system and continue the current model of payment for a number of services. So care outcomes must be measured and reported to validate the contribution of the medical home. And the short-term improvements in costs, I think, are going to come from those that are the most complex. there, the return on investment that we see is that short-term, probably for those of 1 to 5% most most complex are diabetes, congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease patients. But by making sure we reliably deliver the care that we know works, we think that there is a short-term return on investment. The other lifestyle management issues and obesity and smoking cessation are longer-term, but they are real and they are there. Those are my comments.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wood, I don't know if you've if you were watching Carol Levin News about 2 weeks ago, and maybe you can concur. I'm just wondering if this medical home is similar to what, and I'm thinking that this is a CEO from Mayo Clinic who went out there regarding diabetes. And I'm not sure what Utah has. All I know is that he just made this statement on the TV, and it was a short 5-minute clip, and I didn't get to watch the rest of it, but I just want your comments on that, and if that is something that is similar to what we're talking about here today, or what?
Things that I was quoted on.
That's right.
One of the things that Mr. Cupcella asked me is what's the difference in some of the systems are great, some of them are not great, and Dr. Cortese, who I learned to pronounce his name a couple of days ago, what he had said is that if where he'd get his care is Intermountain. When I actually talked to him about that a few days ago, he said, well, it's one of a number of systems. The data that I provided for Mr. Cupcella was that Minnesota does better than Utah and Intermountain in 5 of the 6 diabetes measures. And so we are a state that is statewide is doing better than one on many things than one system out there. So for me, it is the standardized, patient-centered, doing what care that is it has an evidence base to it and makes sense for patients. It is the things that we think about Marcus Welby helping people with before of being guided through a complex system and using the technology to understand our patient populations and apply that technology to them. Intermountain does that very well. I think systems in Minnesota, from Mayo to Health Partners to Fairview to Park Nicollet and St. Mary's Duluth, are leading the country in doing that also.
The two states are actually very similar in the characteristics that have been mentioned, and that is a systematic approach to care. But I would say also that they tend to incorporate the features of being able to get to patients more effectively than perhaps in other areas. If you carefully look at the results achieved in our two states in Medicare, we also tend to utilize far less expensive care, especially toward some of these chronic conditions, and emphasize again the less expensive, low-tech, more patient-centered preventive approaches.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. One thing that was interesting about the article or the clip that was on Carol Levin News was that the interface or the talking amongst systems or within the state of Utah. I'm wondering if we have that excellence so that we should have the capability with technology, and I know that where I go to the hospital and go to the clinic, Alina has in Buffalo has that system, and that I know with my daughter being there just a couple weeks ago in the emergency room that they have the technology and all the things that go along with it. What about the rest of the state of Minnesota? Do we have that? Are we advanced enough for all of the state to be on board, or are we just mainly the metro or the surrounding collar communities in talking with one another and sharing information? Seems like we're so we want to keep it close to our chest. We don't want to share the information of what might be a life-saving system or a process. Just your comments on that, please.
I'll take a crack at it. The With the health information exchange, we are rapidly moving to a place where we can meet the Health Insurance Privacy and Portability Act guidelines for patient confidentiality, but being able to share information. We have the basis for electronic medical records, and I would say St. Mary's Duluth, Mayo, Health Partners Medical Group, Alina Medical, Alina Hospitals and Clinics, Fairview, CentraCare, MerrickCare, and there are we're building systems that will be able to talk to each other at some time. I'll also say that we have had our medical record access from every continent in the world. We had a patient who was in the emergency room at Hong Kong General, who his wife gave his password and sign-on for his congestive heart failure, and they signed on to his medical record within our care system to get important information for the care of that patient, what meds he was on, his left ventricular ejection fraction, and his most latest data. So the systems that we are building will be, we're building the infrastructure for them to communicate with each other well, too. And particularly around redundancy of tests, redundancy of radiology procedures, things that are, we will be able to build, we are building that in.
And Representative Anderson, stay tuned for a bill that Representative Huntley is carrying this year that's going to even, we passed some laws last year to move us in that direction. I think Tom has a bill that's going to even coordinate with a lot of the work that's going on that these guys are doing on that issue.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to know what you're looking at for a timeline. I guess that's another add-on to the questions I asked already.
I think the legislation on health information exchange anticipates that. I think that there is a 2010 or 2015, but I think it's going to move a lot faster than that. I think it'll be within the next couple of years with legislation that allows that to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we spent some time in the working group this summer talking about the health record, electronic health record, and it's whether it was fundamental to the healthcare home. And Dr. Van Ruden from up in Duluth made it clear that it was not a requirement, that yes, it's an electronic record does facilitate this work, but that a healthcare home can't exist without an electronic record, and I think that's very important for us as we talk about this, especially in some of the smaller and rural communities.
And you can actually do the connectivity. So we're doing a project actually with a small family practice in Duluth. They don't have an electronic medical record, but we're giving them access to us for consultations by something as simple as creating a scanned document that you can load into an Adobe file that send to us. We give an answer that turns around quickly, and then that's available by our computer system to the requesting physician. So there are lots of other solutions you can apply.
President Gamos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctors Wood and Rank, thanks for your presentation. First of all, just salute the whole concept of medical home. I think it's absolutely right. In a lot of cases, good providers are already doing this. I mean, you look at a lot of the good primary care clinics, they're already doing a lot of this. And to incent it further, I think, is a great idea. Preventive care, primary care, early intervention, the right way to go. I do have a question, and Representative Murphy touched on it briefly. There is some concern about how we make this work in the two parts of Minnesota. We've got the metro area where these things seem to function very well, where systems of care can readily be coordinated and compared on outcomes and quality and cost. A little more difficult in rural areas. Help me understand a little bit how we make medical home work, very practically speaking, out in places like Elbow Lake and Tinta and North Ulm. And
well, again, it's a concept of care that can be really done anywhere. So it shouldn't be specific to one place or another. It might be a little more evident in terms of looking at outcomes when you're looking at electronic records, which allow you to rapidly extract population-based data. But I think that if you look at some of the clinics that are reporting to the Minnesota Community Health Project, they're not coming from the basis of already a highly wired capability. They are already an established medical home. We have a number of practices who are, as you suggest, who are basically there, may not be as readily able to recognize it.
couple of things. The first is that you're right there. There many practices are medical homes today. The problem is in a payment system that is toxic to that, those will go away over time. Because, as Dr. Wood said, practices can't afford that without the care coordination compensation going in. From my perspective, I think an electronic medical record rapidly allows one to measure population-based health information. I think that from the care coordination, some of the clinics that we've learned from were paper clinics, that we've tried to take those processes that were working really well for them when they became part of us and then put them into an electronic process and system. And so we married both the human aspects of the paper part of this with the electronic part for more rapid measurement. I'm going to speak for myself now. It becomes very difficult to think about a population of 2,000 patients and understanding those invisible patients who don't come into me if I don't have the ability to actually measure that and know who they are. And that's where an electronic health record helps me build in reminders and a care process that makes sure I'm able to take advantage of all that information and then to know when I fail. It is going to be hard to get to medical home without, I think places are there, but from the population health measurement perspective, I think it's going to take broadening electronic medical records to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Rank, since you touched on the topic, I know security is an issue for people whenever we're talking about it, and healthcare is not the only venue in which it's a concern, but you're sharing very sensitive data. It's very important for healthcare. I mean, your description of what happened in China for a patient is a dramatic example. But people are concerned about the security issue as we move very quickly to try to create the electronic medical record infrastructure. There are concerns, stories every other day we hear about large systems being hacked into, laptops being stolen or gone missing. What assurances do we have that these systems are going to be really secure?
I've got one answer, Dr. Wood may have another. I think that for me, I can tell every time an electronic medical record is accessed and who's accessed it. I never could tell that from a paper medical record. And so I have much more security today than we ever had with paper medical records. With respect to the large volume hacking and things like that, we put so many firewalls and redundancies to firewalls in because of the absolute need for confidentiality of patient medical records. We have aggressive policies for making sure that anyone who accesses medical records, we know why and how. And we have fired people for inappropriately accessing medical records. So it is both from a policy perspective and a technology perspective, this is exceptionally important to us, that confidentiality of patient medical records. Having said that, we do believe that there might be a potential break-the-glass function for a one-time function for an emergency room that absolutely needs information on somebody somewhere. And we're trying to figure out what that is so that we're not holding on to extremely important information that would make a life or death difference for somebody. And we call it a break-the-glass function.
President Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, and just a response when I to Representative Gottwald, but then I have a question for Dr. Wood. But first, I talked to a group called First Plan, which is the oldest HMO in the state, started in 1944 in Two Harbors. And they have three primary care clinics in their organization. And I was talking to them a couple of weeks ago, and they have a plan to do exactly what we're talking about with a medical home with their primary care clinics. The trouble is they can't make it work in the fee-for-service system. It just won't work. And so we have to change that fee-for-service system. And then the question for Dr. Wood is, you always give me some intriguing thoughts, but you talked about care teams versus an individual physician and the 2,000 Typical family practice doc would have 2,000 to 2,500 patients. And is there any studies that show that the teams can do it more efficiently, that could jump up to 4,000? Because there was a recent article that said the typical family practice doc would have to work 17 hours a day just to deliver the evidence-based medicine that they're supposed to deliver to those 2,000 patients.
I think really that's the point. If you say that a physician has to do all of those things, then yes, it would take you a long time. But a physician doesn't have to do all of those things. For example, scheduling a mammogram doesn't have to be a physician. There are reminder systems that could be put in place. The mammogram could be done, doesn't require a physician interaction, then it's reviewed, and notations to be made to the physician and the patient together. But if we change what we're doing, I believe we could substantially improve the efficiency of what we are doing as a truly designed system. Now, if we decide we're going to go back at it and say, everything we've done before is based on the concept of an individual physician and how many patients the physician can serve, then I think we'll be very limited in what we can accomplish in the future. There are no studies that have been done on a large scale that demonstrate that capability, but we're working now on changing our care delivery teams, in fact, to reflect that. If you think about it, in the not-too-distant future, what I'm confronting as a leader is how many physicians can I recruit to do the work? I may not be able to recruit enough physicians if I use the current model. If I go to a medical home model and think about using allied health staff and advanced practice nurses, I can recruit teams that can do a lot more.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Really helpful. Mr. Forsythe, Mr. Benner, and Dr. Fazio. Change topic here a little bit to payment reform. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to come today. And if you could just introduce yourself for the tape before we before you start your remarks, that would be great. Whoever wishes to start.
Yes, my name is Keith Benner. I am retired from working with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees for way too long, and I was a member this past summer and fall and winter of the Governor's Transformation Task Force. We're going to try.
You could just scoot over to the mic a little bit, down there. Thanks.
We've divided the presentation up three ways. I'm going to do a lead-in. Tom Forsythe is going to deal with the specifics of the payment recommendation. Charlie will do then a general overview of questions, and all three of us will be available to answer questions. The current payment system is not achieving what we needed to achieve. You've already heard this afternoon testimony from a number of folks as to how that system breaks down. As a provider, you generate revenue and make a profit by providing more services. And the quality of the service you provide or the need for that service does not enter into what you're paid. It's easiest to bill for traditional services, office visits, procedures, tests. The way the system works today, you either can't or in any event, it is extremely difficult to bill for e-visits, for teamwork, the shorthand we use is the tiering of the office visit. Our payment system, by and large, does not take into account quality. It does not take into account efficiency. It does not take into account outcomes. It does not take into account alternative health delivery methods. And our biggest concerns should be people's health, and should be how to most efficiently help people get and stay healthy. We know in Minnesota and in the country the quality of care varies significantly. Payment does not. We know in Minnesota and in the country overall cost of care varies significantly and payment does not. If you have gone on either the Minnesota Community Measurement website or the Minnesota Hospital Association website, you can see significant differences in primary care outcomes, significant differences in inpatient care outcomes. And if you go to a couple places where you start to be able to see compared cost data, you will see significant differences there also. One example that I like to use comes from the State of Minnesota Employee Group, where care systems are rated based upon the overall cost of care they provide. And this overall cost of care is risk adjusted, so we are actually comparing apples and apples. There is, in 2008, a 60% variation from least expensive care system to most expensive care system in the state of Minnesota that treats state of Minnesota employees, their spouses, their kids, and in many cases, treats you and your staff. The Transformation Task Force, I think, spent most of its time trying to grapple with issues of payment reform. How can we create a payment system that actually incents the care we want to incent, that deals with issues of variability of quality, that deals with issues of variability of cost? We also tried to do it recognizing that there are some things we in Minnesota are not going to control. We're not going to control Medicare. The feds determine that, and while we can make some recommendations to them, we can make some requests for waivers to them, we are trying to deal with a situation where what can we do that we can control here in Minnesota. A similar set of issues involves self-insured employers. We understand that self-insured employers at the end of the day can, if they wish to be outside a payment reform structure, we recommend, but we would be hoping what we come up with is something that self-insured employers would want to join. We also tried to grapple with how to build, the phrase we use, a critical mass for payment reform. We heard loud and clear from providers that if every different payer wants to do something slightly different, and they're sending them different signals, it's not behavior, we're just going to wind up with much. We need to find ways that in terms of the signals we're sending to providers, the signals are as consistent as possible, and that they are requesting the same sort of behavior, or each payment system is requesting a similar, if not the same sort of behavior by that provider. And I guess with that as a lead-in, I'll turn this over to Tom Forsythe.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, it's my pleasure to be here. I'm a vice president at General Mills, and what I do there would suggest that I shouldn't really be here. But one of the things I do there is I am the company's health policy guy. And I have been for quite a long time now. And my health policy experience predates that. So I've been around state level reforms for 20 years or so and national level reforms for about the same amount of time. I was also privileged to serve as a member of the Transformation Task Force. And what I've been asked to review with you here today is the recommendations regarding payment reform and therefore delivery reform. I think the task force recommendation has many facets, all of which are important. Public health, insurance reform, but to me the most important parts are payment reform and delivery reform. You've heard from many that the problem in healthcare is that, I think, healthcare costs too much. Hopefully you've heard that from others. If not, you just heard it from me. And the problem, in my view, is that we have to find a way to pay differently for those things we can consume, and therefore, we also want to see them delivered in a slightly different way. And as Keith said, we spent quite a lot of time on that. Our principle here on the task force was that we believe healthcare systems should be restructured in terms of payment to support and encourage evidence-based high-value healthcare. And we said that took the following forms: that providers should be accountable for, and more importantly, should compete on based on the cost and quality of the care they deliver for the population that they care for. That individuals should be empowered with information, both as to quality and as to cost, that would help them be more responsible in choosing providers based on value and with minimal restrictions on switching providers. That the payment systems that we would develop, therefore, should support those mechanisms as well as improved coordination of care, including the medical home concept that you've just heard discussed. And importantly, at the guts of our recommendations on this point are that there should be full transparency and vigorous provider competition on price and quality. So we looked at how best to do that, and our view was that payment reforms should be developed to achieve greater responsibility and provider accountability on quality, efficiency, care coordination, and total cost of care in three stages. Some providers, such as large integrated care systems, may be ready to immediately implement level three. Others may only be prepared to implement level one, and that's okay. We have to find a way to transform from the system we have today to a system that is competing based on cost and quality, and we have to start from where we are. Level one would work like this. It would involve making payments to providers explicitly on the quality and efficiency of care they provide, so that providers meeting specific targets or who show a significant amount of improvement would be eligible for increased quality efficiency-based payments. On the whole, we believe that that could be budget neutral to the system, that the quality and efficiency measures would be based on measures with a priority on outcomes, but would probably be based on processes at the beginning. For primary care providers, that would mean that the quality measures would focus on things like preventative services, coronary artery, heart disease, diabetes, asthma, etc. For specialty care, where the availability of quality measures is somewhat more limited, specialty societies have developed quality indicators that can be measured and reported, and that they should be encouraged to develop those. Level two of our payment reform would involve providers assuming greater responsibility for coordinating care for patients, particularly those with chronic conditions, and that includes serving as medical homes or healthcare homes. And they would receive care management fees for monitoring and managing care. That would be adjusted based on the complexity of the person you're taking care of, so your care management fee for a healthy person that you don't see might be very small. Your care management fee for someone who has complex disease or a chronic condition would be higher. And that providers would need to meet specific standards, including having specific types of care management systems in place to receive those fees. That's level two. Level three of payment reform would involve providers and care systems assuming responsibility for total cost of care for the patients they provide, as well as the quality of the care they provide. And here's how that would work. Providers or care systems would submit bids to health insurance companies and to healthcare purchasers, consortiums of plans and purchasers, based on the total cost to provide care for a sample population. So they would all be bidding on providing the same care to the same sample population. They would have different prices. They would also have different measures of quality. Based on the price that they submit for providing care for that entire population, their price would be priced through to the market of consumers, of insurance companies, of employers, and consumers would then be engaged at that level to choose a provider, choose a care system, based on cost and quality. So that's how level three would work. Now, the payment to physicians and providers in this scenario would be adjusted based on risk. And there is no transfer of risk. So this is not capitation. This is not insurance. This is just a mechanism for bidding the price of the care you're going to provide and competing based on price and quality. The amount of care you provide is adjusted based on risk. So if you get a sicker person, by chance, because we can adjust for that, you would receive an adjustment inside of your payment mechanism. And here's how this would work as you're being paid throughout the year. If you are doing a very good job on quality, and if you are taking great care of people, and you're not delivering as much care, but they're healthy, and they're not using care, your payments would actually be increased to bring you in at the target that you said you would be bidding. If, however, you're providing not as high quality of care, readmission, more services than you would have projected based on your bid, your reimbursements would be reduced to bring you back to the level that you bid. This system is the one that we implemented with the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, and we have a lot of testing on it. So we actually operated this system for many years. and the risk adjustment worked, the payment mechanism worked, and we did see competition based on total cost of care with this level 3 model when we were running that plan. So that's level 1, 2, and 3, but I didn't get to talk about the thing that I actually like the most. The thing I like the most about our recommendations is transparent pricing and transparent quality. So in addition to these types of things, we would also create a mechanism for consumers to look at prices, and a mechanism for providers to post prices, and a mechanism to show measures of quality. And we would see physicians, other providers, competing on the basis of the price they put to the market and on the quality of the services they provide, and consumers would be able to gauge on that level. So transparent pricing, even for baskets of care, is a key element of what we suggest. There's more to what we recommend. I don't want to go through it in too level of detail. I know that you've already had a chance to see this report. Suffice it to say, I believe it is one of the most important things in the task force recommendations. Unless we can find a way to pay for things differently, we cannot rein in the cost of health care. Payment reform and delivery reform are key.
Dr. Fazio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I'm Charles Fazio. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Medica, and I, too, or three, had the chance to be on the Transformation Task Force, and it was a pleasure to be with that group. To sort of wrap things up with where we went as it related to payment reform, there were a number of details we didn't work out. We didn't have the people at the table, and despite the outstanding support we got from the health department and the staff to the committee, we couldn't work out all the details in the time that we had to work through the plan. So there are a number of details missing as it relates, for instance, to some of the packaging and some of the transparency, how prices would be set, whether they're negotiated prices or fixed prices and things like that. So there are things mentioned in the report that haven't been worked through. I think the most significant part of the report is that it's a package. If we're going to change the cost of health care by 20%, which was our goal, there isn't any one part of the report that works without the other parts. We can't not do the public health and expect the medical system to continue to take care of people. We can't change the payment reform but not change insurance benefits so people have incentives to participate. Similarly, with payment reform, taking options 1 and 2 and leaving out level 3 really doesn't work. Levels 1 and 2 are tinkering with the current system. Level 3 is what we get to transformation. It's level 2 where we start to support the concept of medical home by paying for care differently and letting people other than physicians be on the front line of how we provide and coordinate care. And level 3 takes that to a whole different and new degree and actually gets to the transformation in a different world. And so we hope as we think about this that we don't think of stopping short and thinking 1 or 2 gets us part of the way there. 1 or 2 doesn't do it. It's getting to 3 that makes the difference. As Tom mentioned, measurement is critical to what we do. People have to know what it is they're seeking and know what it is they're getting or what kind of expectations they should have when they enter the system. Much of what we're talking about is already in play. There are pilots in the community right now of people in level 2 payments of care. There will be pilots yet this calendar year of people in level 3 payments of care. There is enough urgency around all of this that the community will move on a lot of these things, even in the absence of any sort of legislation, just because the consumer and the purchaser need for those things to happen. I wanted to mention the concept of rural communities as it came up both for medical home and for level 3 payments. Where you practice, in my mind, has nothing to do with your capability of being efficient, providing patient-centered care, and of achieving success either in level 2, care coordination in medical home, or level 3, even being accountable for total cost of care. Being accountable for total cost of care doesn't mean you provide it all. It simply means you help patients find it all. So whether a practitioner is 50 miles from a tertiary care center or down the block from one, they have referral patterns, they have specialists they use, they know who they hope that their patients will see when they need care outside the community. And so helping to coordinate that is not an issue necessarily of where you practice. I can tell you from experience
that I spent 10 years practicing in a place that was 20 miles from a traffic light and 50 miles from a tertiary care center, and we knew the specialists we wanted to use, and I'm willing to bet we were as efficient as every other care system in our total cost of care based on how we practice and where we send people for the care that we couldn't provide. When we look back at Medicare, forget put my health plan hat on for a little while, at risk-adjusted total cost of care on a patient-attributed basis, there's a lot of variability in the seven-county metro area, and there is not consistently higher or lower performance than in rural Minnesota. So we should not think of a rural practice as being a barrier to level three kind of payment. Not everybody might get there. Some practices may choose to look for partnerships to participate in level three payment, but you can also participate in level three payment without formal partnership and with the vast majority of the care being supplied in your community. The other things about this, again, I think the distinction between this and capitation are important. A lot of people have said, no, level three, you're just wanting us to capitate people again. That didn't work last time. Capitation didn't work for a lot of different reasons. Many of those are no longer pertinent, having to do with better assessment tools, better risk models, and things like that. But the other part of that is this is not capitation. This separates clinical risk and helping a group of people be healthier from insurance risk, which is somebody who has a pool of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people ought to manage, and it does recommend that we separate those two.
Thank you. Questions? President Trump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Witnesses, you know, in all this discussion about health care reform, we eventually get to, and sometimes rapidly get to, issues of cost. I was interested in your comment that this is a package proposal. And so my question is, what kind of upfront costs are we looking at? If we were to pass or adopt this, how much money do we have to invest in the next biennium to make it work, to launch it? Any idea? Or maybe it doesn't require any money.
For payment reform? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
The, boy, the, I'm not trying to be a smart ass on this point.
I'm not either.
The costing of transition stuff that's one of those details the Transformation Task Force did not get to. I think if you look at the proposals for things to happen in the back half of 08 and the first half of 09 that are in the bill, most of those are in terms of creating working groups to be able to start to put together the infrastructure pieces to bring back to you in the 2009 session for more detailed action. So we are not talking large amounts of money this session in terms of getting things in shape to bring back actionable items for the nine.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add to that, as I understood it, the largest investments were in the public health component of the plan, and the department staff has those numbers, but I don't have them with us. Much of the rest could be implemented over time without significant investments, as I recall.
And I think that's the right answer, Representative Schumper. Mr. Forsythe.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add to that, short answer, I don't know either. I can tell you that a lot of this stuff has already been done. So as for the risk adjuster, it's already been built, could be turned on relatively quickly. As for the payment mechanism that we use to facilitate payments and execute exactly this model when we were doing it under BCAG, you know, this is beyond what I probably am able to follow through, but I think we'd probably give it to you. So some of these things are perceived as barriers. Some of these things should not be perceived quite as much as barriers. And then, you know, I do think that the bulk of what the task force recommended is inside of public health as it relates to cost. Our charge was to save money. And we think that if we could implement fully payment reform and delivery reform, we have the chance to spend less, not more.
President Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for any of the testifiers.
it's still difficult for some people to get their heads around level three because it does imply changes in systems. There are different hoops that people are going to have to jump through to get those payments. They're going to have to report quality measures they haven't reported before. They're going to have to set up systems they haven't set up before to get these payments. In rural areas, hospitals as well as individual clinics have expressed concerns along the lines of what Dr. Fazio mentioned about capitation and recognizing that that's not what this is. But still concerns about how do you hold me accountable for total cost of care and how am I going to compete when I'm the sole provider in a rural area? Some answers to those things. We've talked a lot about, and I appreciate Representative Chumper's question about the cost to the state over the next biennium or two, but the cost to providers of implementing some of these systems has not really been discussed. And I know it's been raised with a number of providers who've come to me about this. We don't simply throw a switch and this suddenly works overnight, or we might have done it sooner. BCAG, for example, somewhat successful, somewhat not successful here in the Twin Cities Metro. I don't know that it was ever tried on a statewide basis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I can tell you that, yes, we were certainly well beyond the metro area when we were operating the BCAG plan. I will take some fault for the failure of that plan. I think we just simply weren't aggressive enough. If we had been more aggressive, our plan was functioning fabulously. We had 21 competing care systems who had submitted bids exactly on this basis. They were paid on this basis for several years. It was built on the back of the existing fee-for-service payment system so that we used the exact same mechanism, the same codes, and the only adjustment was to bring you into line with the bid that you originally set. So in the end, whether you provided more services or less, you got the same amount of money, and that system worked very, very well for many years. As for compiling the bids, I think there may be a learning curve on that front for some, but there is a lot of knowledge in the state about how to prepare such bids. Some parts are already continuing to work with CGIP, so it should not be viewed as an insurmountable barrier, and I think we're actually much farther along than you might suggest, and I'll leave the rural question over to Charlie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwell. I think if you can imagine different practitioners you've seen over your personal encounters with the healthcare system, I suspect some of you have seen people who answered the question, maybe, that you went there for that day and were a little concerned about anything else that happened. And other people who were there wanting to figure out why you were there that day, understanding what the real issues were, and thinking about your health in a broader context. You heard earlier today about an MRI that might cost $1,000 or an MRI that might cost $5,000. And then you think about the faith that so many people have in the place they think of as their clinical home or their medical home, if we can evolve more to that concept. If I'm helping coordinate your care, then I don't have to provide it all, even if I'm in a little town on Mille Lacs Lake. But I know the specialists who see the problem through and then send you back to us so that we can coordinate what's going on for you. I know the places that do the MRIs well so that we get the right test the first time and we get it at a fair price. And I know the hospitals that are efficient in how they perform your care, even if I send you to the Twin Cities from my rural community. So what we're really talking about is having a greater interest and maybe even a financial stake to some level in whether or not somebody gets good care, where in the system somebody ends up, the quality of the practitioners they see, and the outcomes achieved in the past by the practitioners they see. And if we go to more of a model that's risk-adjusted total cost of care for you and everybody downstream from what happens with your patients, then we move away from a system where I can do my part and bail, and it doesn't matter how many services you get, whether you need them or not, to a system where people are accountable. And they're accountable for clinical outcomes and financial outcomes, and we have to package that, we think, together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Fazio or any of the testifiers, I think people get the medical home piece of that, even in rural areas. I think that's understandable. What isn't as well understood is if you're in Elbow Lake, Minnesota, and you're a one- or two-doc shop, and you're operating on a thin margin already, or you're a rural hospital operating on a thin margin, you've got to, the learning curve, as you put it, some might call it systems costs or other things, so you've got to put some investment into doing this. Now you're being held accountable, much like No Child Left Behind in educational terms, to meeting certain quality standards and either getting more payment or less payment. And if you don't happen to hit those marks for whatever reason, you may be out of business as the sole provider in a given market. So I understand the medical home concept. In fact, Dr. Fazio and I worked in one of the state's community integrated service networks together in St. Cloud, Minnesota, a while back. But trying to figure out how this works in practical terms from a payment and systems methodology for small providers and rural providers is still difficult to understand. A lot of them who do more of this than I do have come to me with those very same concerns. What does this mean? What do I have to do to get on board with this? And what happens if I don't suddenly meet the quality standards that somebody's dictated for payment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butwald, let me, I guess, try to give you a partial answer from the experience of the state employee group. The state employee plan has gone halfway to level three. Instead of asking care systems to submit a upfront bid, it analyzes after the fact the cost data that has come in from the prior period. And then based on that comes up with a risk adjusted per member per month. They will then take that information and sit down with care system specific organizations and say, here's what you are. Can we sit down and try to work on the fee schedule to help you get to a better place? And then I say that's about partway to, a true level three. I know those discussions have taken place in the metro area in greater Minnesota. In much of greater Minnesota, there are either one purchasing cooperative of clinics, the one that comes to mind is, I think I got the name right, Minnesota Rural Healthcare, which is a large number of very small clinics in west central, south central Minnesota. And they, as a group, come in and deal with state employees, with just like they would with the health plan on the fee schedule issue. And then for the very, very small, the state employee group simply creates a paper care system that's called independent providers in Southwest Minnesota, independent providers in Northwest Minnesota. And we don't actually try to force those folks to go through all the hoops of everybody else, because when you're looking at where the patients are, where you're looking at even greater Minnesota right now, most of greater Minnesota, medicine is run by a relatively small number of large organizations. So, you know, there one possible outcome of this is care systems or practices wind up in different places based upon their own capacity to respond, and people being in different places in that sense is okay if we have the core incentives working in particular where the money is, where the large practices are.
Dr. Fazio.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butwald again. So that's the financial part. We didn't work out all the details. But from a clinical point of view, if we were about to pay level two kinds of medical home payments to a group or transition to level three, and especially if we were going to provide assistance to that, I'd much rather work through the changes in care design and the efficiency in a six-person shop in rural Minnesota with a community hospital than with a 50 or 100 person shop tied to a Twin Cities hospital. I think you are much more able to affect change in those communities. So I think the size, while it can be a disadvantage financially, I think we can work through some of that the way Pete was talking about. And from a clinical delivery system point of view, I think you have greater ability to implement change.
Representative Huntley.
Well, this is a little story about the rural health care.
We like
stories. I hate to tell you how long ago this happened, but this I think was BTAG was just starting, and they had somebody, may have been Health Partners, that had come up with a new way to treat women with urinary tract infections. and they had reduced the, I think the average cost was $200, and they reduced it to $45. And I thought this was, I thought I was the smartest guy in the world that I knew this now, and all these rural docs wouldn't know anything. And a week later, I'm doing a two-day visit with, half a day with the, each doc, and so there's four docs. One of them is Ray Christensen in Moose Lake. And so I'm sitting there, and he's, this woman comes in, and she had a urinary tract inspection, and he asked her, you ever had this before? She said, yes, in 1960. I mean, she knew exactly what she had. And he did exactly what BTAG had said they should do, and gave her the proposed, you know, antibiotics, and sent her on her way, and said, you know, if this doesn't work in 3 days, give me a call. And so I brought this up to him, and I said, well, why did you, have you been talking to BTAG or what? And he said, no, he said, I always do it that way. He said, she has to drive 35 miles to get here. Why would I want her to come back the next day for another visit? And so just because you're in rural Minnesota, you can be right at the cutting edge, particularly with the way we can transfer information around today.
I missed the story. Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, that really wasn't a question, but it doesn't stop me from answering anyway. I would just say that we were tasked with trying to change the way healthcare works because it costs too much. And therefore, we had to go after delivery reform. And if you're actually going to try to change the way that we deliver and consume healthcare, we have to change the way that we pay for it. And so we were asked to be revolutionary. We were asked, in fact, we were given a goal that I thought was too big. And we were asked to try to meet it. And the only way to get there, if we're truly going to do transformation, is to do something big. However, we also knew that we had to be evolutionary, that we had to go from where we are today to where we needed to go, and that we had to bring everyone with us. So I just wanted to restate that the level one we can do today. Level two we can do very soon as we work out the details for it. And what we want to do there is we want to pay for care coordination, pay more, because we believe it will save us money. And then in the end, we want to get to a point where people are competing on the total cost of care, not being paid on an episodic basis. So I just wanted to reinforce that the level one, level two, level three was part of the plan so that we could be evolutionary and hopefully in the end be revolutionary. Which was not at all responsive to Representative Huntley's story.
It's a good way to sum up, though, I think. Thank you very much for coming down. And members, I do think that this is a very important piece of this discussion, because I truly think it's what it will allow doctors and medical practitioners to practice the way they want to practice. I mean, all the things you hear them complaining about moving in this direction, I think, removes a lot of those obstacles and barriers. And so I hope that there is an open mind as we move forward. And it's interesting on this No Child Left Behind analogy. You guys must be on the same, the left and the right must be on the same talking points on that one, because I'm hearing it from both sides. But I think the analogy would really be if No Child Left Behind were put in place, but the teachers were the ones that were able to say, and I get to determine how much money I have, which is the complaint of No Child Left Behind is that they don't. And so I think if we're going to make the truly accurate metaphor, that would be the one. On to universal coverage. Representative Loeffler and Dr. Westner, welcome.
Thank you. My name is David Westner. I'm the chief executive of Park Nicollet Health Services, and
I'm Representative Diane Loeffler.
And we've been asked to speak to the element of universal coverage within the recommendations before you. And I've had the privilege of serving on the Transformation Task Force over the last several months, and would just remark that it has been a remarkable effort of a diverse group of leaders to come up with
what is before you is a blueprint to really accomplish what is called in healthcare circles the triple aim, which is Dr. Rank spoke about, which is to optimize the patient's experience, the individual's experience in healthcare, the health of the population, and the per capita cost. And that is a challenge to optimize those three things. That is really what this is all about. And I think there is a blueprint here to accomplish that. And the parts which we've been talking about is transparency in terms of quality and cost, public health interventions to create a culture of health within the state, design and coordination of care at both the patient and population level. Both are important. A means to manage and hold the system accountable for cost and quality, and very importantly, universal access, which is enabled by the insurance reform and the payment reform, which, without which, universal access, I do not believe is feasible, but with it, I think it is not only feasible, but important to accomplish. I would say that the conversation, and just to bring my perspective as a leader of a system of care to the issue of payment reform, because payment reform is vitally linked to accomplishing universal access. So when we talk about who ought to be responsible for optimizing this question of the experience of the patient, and the cost of care and the health of the population. Who ought to be responsible for that? The popular response to that is always the doctor and the patient ought to be so. And we know that, however, we also need accountability to add to that. And I believe that level 3 payment combines the flexibility and the ability to be patient-centered and respond to each patient's individual needs, which is we need to put that accountability as close to that doctor-patient relationship as possible. The farther away from the doctor and patient we put the accountability for the cost of care, the less flexible it will be, the less patient-centered it will be, the less acceptable it will be to the people of the state. And so we need to look at this system as being really something that's going to enable that to be optimized for each patient's payment. And in doing so, it allows flexibility at the patient to do the right thing for the patient, and yet to create learning systems within this organization so that the patterns of care can be studied and the quality can be advanced. So it's very critical that we get this payment right, and that lays the groundwork for universal access. Without that, we have a runaway train, and we cannot hook up the state budget or anyone else's budget to universal access unless we have a system that balances and optimizes those three aims. Now, this country has long ago legislated the requirement that we provide care to everyone. The EMTALA law, 1986, was really a requirement that in emergency rooms you must treat any patient that appears before you ever ask a question about insurance or look for an insurance card. That is standard work within our entire system. Now we have to follow up, I believe, and follow through on that commitment to do it humanely and to do it efficiently and to do it the right way, both for the patient and for the system that's responsible for doing that. So right now the EMTALA law overloads the part of our system that is most stressed in responding to emergencies of care, true emergencies, because it is the access point of last resort for individuals in our community who have no other access point. And so we overload this overstressed part of our system to great disadvantage for every citizen, because truly emergencies are compromised as a result of overloading it with
patients who could be better treated for in a medical home. But because we do not have universal access, we have this particular problem. We have less of a problem in Minnesota, thank goodness, than other states do. And in fact, that's one of the things that we should take advantage of, is that we are so close. And so this is doable. This is something we can accomplish if we have the will to do it, and we should do it. So we have to face up to the integrity of our system today. We've made this commitment, but we do not do it humanely. And so we require retreatment for all, but deny coverage for the most effective and cost-efficient care. And we have to ask ourselves, who are we fooling? Well, we're not fooling anyone. We're not fooling anyone, and in fact, it's one of the reasons that our system is the butt of jokes around the world in terms of we consume twice as much money as other systems of care and underperform. So this, I think the joke is on us, and this is something that we have to stand up to really look at how we can do this better. There's enough money in the system if we channel it effectively. And so these recommendations that are before you channel the money effectively and challenge every part of the system appropriately to accomplish a much better result so that we get effectiveness, efficiency, patient-centeredness, timeliness, and equity. Equity is very important. And equity is something, no matter how hard we try within the healthcare system to accomplish, we cannot within the healthcare system. We can do a lot of things about quality and cost and everything else, but we cannot fix equity. Equity is something really in your hands here at the legislature in order to step up to the issue about equity within within our state. And there are many, many advantages then to accomplish that equity. One of which is adverse selection. Without that, we have people buying insurance who need to buy insurance, and those that don't need to buy insurance are less likely to buy it. And so we have adverse selection, which raises the cost of insurance, and as a result of that, we have less affordable care, which exacerbates the problem. If we solve this problem, a lot of other things go away. A lot of other problems go away. Disproportionate share payments in terms of the unequal load of the economically disadvantaged. MCHA payments, another thing that can go away. Higher fees that are there to cover the cost of uninsured are reduced. Capacity in our emergency departments that are struggling to meet demand would be increased. You could argue maldistribution of healthcare workers and resources among different communities would be affected by dealing with universal access. And then, of course, health disparities, which, despite Minnesota being a very having a very high standard in terms of health and healthcare, what drags us down in comparison with other states is the great differential between people of different races and ethnicities in terms of their health. And so that is a mar on and a disgrace at the state level. So all of this is, I think, hangs together as a set of recommendations, and universal access is really important. And there are a couple other things about it. If involvement and personal responsibility is part of the answer in terms of cost of health care, then we have to make sure that everyone is personally involved in order to have an effect on that cost. If we believe that market dynamics are part of the answer to the cost of care, and I believe they are, then we need to make sure that those dynamics don't operate at the expense of those who can't afford to participate. And so all of that adds up to the fact that we really have an opportunity here. And you might say that this is a difficult time to look at something like that because of a budget deficit. I would argue that that's the right time to look at solving this problem because we have to do it within our means. if we were just going to spend a surplus to solve this problem, we would just be postponing the problem of doing it right. We have less means than we would like right now, but I think that provides the discipline that we need to solve this within the means that we have. And we have the means necessary to solve this. So a lot of my peers in this industry are all anxious, and I'm anxious about these changes. Change is hard. It will require significant accommodation and rethinking about what we have to accomplish. But health care is very important to Minnesota. It's important to us as citizens. It's important to us in our economy. A very significant part of our economy is based on health care. And I believe that if we adopt this type of reform, Minnesota will be in a position to be in the lead, not only in the states of the U.S., but internationally, in innovating around what's the best way to deal with each patient's needs humanely and do that in a way that accomplishes population health and low cost per capita. That is an international challenge, and no one has really solved it. But I believe the recommendations that you have before you set us up to be leaders in healthcare, as we have been historically and need to be in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Listener Wasser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As was mentioned by Dr. Wasser, Minnesota has consistently rated at the top in the nation's rankings of coverage of uninsured people. We have 93% of our Minnesota residents covered by health insurance now, which is pretty phenomenal. And it's because of a partnership that I think you're seeing in these total recommendations, which is we had employers who are willing to step up, more so than I think employers in other states have. We've been able to adopt public policies by creating general assistance medical care, Minnesota care, insurance policies in terms of pricing and risk sharing, and the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, that meant that anyone who's willing to step up and get insurance has access to a relatively affordable product. And so it was good news when we learned that despite the economy that's worsening, we still haven't seen the fall off in that insurance rate that other states have. And because we're looking at a 7% gap rather than a 20-plus percent gap like some states, that gives us some opportunities to pursue this in other ways. We think that in order to achieve universal coverage with everyone having affordable, accessible, quality insurance, we're going to need to make sure that we have all the pieces in place, some of which have been just reviewed in our presentations this afternoon. Absolutely, affordability and cost is the biggest barrier, whether you're buying an individual policy or an employer trying to find affordable coverage for his or her employees. And so cost containment and the affordability standard with premium subsidies, expanded access to Minnesota care is part of building that base for those remaining 400,000 people. Expanding our outreach efforts to get more of the people who are currently eligible for Minnesota care medical assistance aware of that opportunity and signed up and on to those programs regularly will also be a component of it. And we need an accessible and understandable market. And on the Insurance Reform Work Group for the Healthcare Access Commission that I co-chaired with Senator Mary Olson, we had a small businessman who said one of their biggest challenges was just getting quotes. It's hard enough to figure out how to run a successful small business in a competitive market, let alone having to understand and learn insurance and how to access it and what kind of policy might be right. And we're hoping that the health insurance exchange and standardizing the policies will make it more possible for people to more easily get into the market, whether they're a small business or an individual. And then we need insurance regulations that will sort of wrap around this on affordability for people who are in the private market. We've got the affordability provisions that deal with people who are under 400% of poverty, but we still need to look at how the basic underwriting of insurance works. And so the recommendation is that we stabilize rates in the private market and open up the market to additional individuals through reform related to how we price insurance in the private market. And right now, Minnesota allows a wide variety of factors to be used in pricing. And that includes occupation, geography, health status, age. And we're suggesting that it go down to a minimal community rating, which is will spread the risk across a broader range of the public rather than only having the healthy advantage. And so we're suggesting that occupation and health status be dropped as part of the measures while still allowing health risks, such as smoking status, to be part of the determination of race. And that should assist small employers. We've all heard the story of a small employer who has one person who has a terrible health condition arise, and all of a sudden their rates are going through the ceiling. We think we can stabilize the market through a variety of insurance reform mechanisms, and that can help more people access it. And so we think that closing the gap between the 400,000 to getting everyone covered is manageable, but it's only going to happen if we establish for ourselves some robust goals and some plans to get there. And so in the proposed legislation and healthcare access report, we suggested that we would get to 94% coverage by the end of fiscal year 2009, 96% in 2011, 97% in 2012, and keep moving forward. The Healthcare Access Commission wrestled with the idea of an individual mandate, as did the Transformation Task Force. And the Healthcare Access Commission decided, instead of imposing a mandate at the beginning, like Massachusetts has, that instead we should really take advantage of the fact that we are this close compared to other states and the proven ability of us to influence the markets to get more people to take advantage of it by instead imposing a trigger, which would mean if we have not achieved the goals that we have set forth for ourselves, including the needed backup systems of affordability and cost containment and insurance reform, by 2011, that then we would have a year to contemplate putting in place the kind of mechanisms that you might want to consider in implementing a mandate, but that we would continue to move forward with a voluntary effort first and see if we might be able to narrow that gap more appropriately while working on all these other components that you've heard about this afternoon. So it would be a trigger at which point we would be asked as legislators to look at what would be needed to implement a mandate and should we do that. Vermont has established this system. They have a trigger point that goes into effect, I think, in 1 year, and if they're not able to achieve that kind of coverage. And so we're hoping that you will look favorably at this approach while allowing us to prove that the cost containment, affordability, expanded eligibility provisions can work to keep narrowing that gap in Minnesota. Was that
the question? No. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler. I was just wondering, as I understand from the provider community, from about 5 weeks ago, the MMA issued a letter in which they expressed a series of concerns with access and coverage, particularly with the level 3 portion of the recommendations to achieve universal care. Are you aware of any changes that the MMA has had since their 5 weeks ago? Have you been talking to them? Do you know if they've moved at all? Or?
I will. We already did at prior testimonies. I understand that. But there have been conversations with the MMA on an ongoing basis since that letter came out to talk through some of those issues.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, one of the things that I have been struggling with in looking at this is to achieve universal care is to get the right care at the right place at the right time for the right cost across the state. I think that's something that everybody shares as a goal. And Mr. Westner, you're good enough to give me a tour of your facility and some of the great things that you folks are doing over there, and certainly applaud what you are doing in there. And looking at moving this toward the statewide plan, how big do you get it before it's too big? I know that Minnesota has tried capitation in the past. Other states have tried over the past 25 years. And as we look towards moving back, that first we want to do no harm as we move forward. One of the pieces of moving towards universal coverage that I kind of struggle with is, in reading through the recommendations in the task force, is that we are not covering the fact that our public programs reimburse at a rate which does not cover the cost of treatment. And that's something that affects access. And that as we move towards this, if we have more and more folks being reimbursed at a cost less than it is to produce those services, we're going to continue to have access erosion, particularly in greater Minnesota. So I just was wondering if you had worked on that or chipped away at that a little bit more since you and I had last had a conversation.
That is a concern. Hopefully, as much as possible, we would be purchasing this sort of coverage in plans that are paid by this idea of a single price that it will hopefully be lower, because it is not something that where we're offsetting low prices and have to raise that price to others. So right now, of course, Medicare pays below cost, and as a result of that, the rates that are charged to everyone else are higher to offset that. And so the solution can't be just to move more and more patients to a below-cost rate, or we will actually see a destabilization of the system. So hopefully this idea of creating a single price which is competitive and tested in a marketplace is going to be something that we can move people to, and look at what are the appropriate subsidies so that it's affordable to every individual. I just another thing to note about this system of pricing is that right now the way prices are set in healthcare in Minnesota is by negotiation between healthcare providers and health plans. And that negotiation is a struggle of strength, basically, of size. And so if anything, that system has tended to create larger and larger healthcare organizations and larger health plans. And as was said earlier, that may in fact not be the answer in terms of creating the best care or the best efficiency or the best approach to accomplishing the triple aim. So I think the recommendations that are in the task force's work around pricing is saying that we really believe that the market is probably the sternest disciplinarian of price that we can come up with, and that if structured appropriately, that can work most effectively in making sure that we are getting the best buy in healthcare that's possible. But it's not necessarily going to come out of negotiation. It would come out of a market well-structured and designed to be safe for every individual to participate in. So that's what we have to accomplish.
Mr. Chair, forgive me if the MMA was up here earlier and had addressed this as well, but I had another committee that I've been bouncing back and forth to. But I would like to ask Mr. Westner if he has looked at this at all within the course of the Transformation Task Force, of moving from level 2 to level 3, level 3 all-encompassing, not immediately, but a trajectory that would get to the entire state. Have you looked at a system within that would be representative of a large group, perhaps, for example, folks with chronic conditions, diabetes, hypertension, within a larger set to try this capitation on, or within a group of a public program or a large company? Did you look at all at within the task force at something that was not a trajectory that would get to the entire state, but one that was large enough to give a representative of, can we get capitation to work at all and in some at a different level than the entirety of the state?
And Dr. West, just to be clear, there was testimony earlier, this is not capitation. But Dr. Westner, yeah. Go ahead.
Mr. Westner and
Mr. Westner, I'm sorry. Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, we did look at that, and actually the greatest test as to whether this type of system works is, would be critical mass. And so if we are going to implement it in a narrow way, the real message will be is that it can be ignored and minimized. Mm-hmm. And really the thing that would make this most transformative is if we try to apply it broadly. And this is not capitation. This is a way to set price that rewards the creation of population health, and as opposed to a medical arms race. And so that type of pricing can work. It's worked in the example that Tom Forsyth described in terms of the Buyer's Healthcare Action Group. I mean, that had the mechanism of it, but that didn't. The reason it hadn't had a bigger effect was because it didn't have the critical mass, so that it became the quote coin of the realm. So whatever is the coin of the realm, or the way in which price is set, the way in which value is determined, that is going to drive the system. And I think you can actually set the date whereby this would become effective out 5 years. And as long as it's certain that we're headed there, the trajectory of the system will start to change immediately, because it's clear that this is going to be the way in which we determine how you can provide health care and do so economically, and it would have a great effect on decisions now, even if it weren't actually required until a much later date.
Thank you, Mr. Westner. Thank you again for your hospitality and for all the great work that you're doing. And I promise not to call it capitation again.
Thank you. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, we just received a letter in the last week, or a memo from the MMA, and I thought that was distributed. Apparently it just got to Healthcare Access Commission members. But I'll have that emailed to everybody shortly. And yes, they're still nervous about level 3.
Any other questions, members? Hey, thank you for coming today. Really appreciate it. To talk about Thursday briefly, this is for the policy committee. We will be starting at 12:30 again, and in that first section, which is really typically the finance committee period of time, we're going to have presentations on the bill. There actually are two bills. Representative Loeffler has a public health portion, it's 3390, and then Representative Huntley's carrying the rest of the bill, which is 3391. So those, we'll just walk through the bills in the first part of the section, 1230 to 215. Then we'll be taking testimony for the rest of the public testimony for the rest of the afternoon until 3:45 to our typical time ends, and then we'll be coming back at 6 p.m. To work through the bill, to walk through amendments, and we'll have a vote on the bill on Thursday evening. No finance committee on Thursday. There will be tomorrow, and then the finance committee will not be meeting on Thursday. There is session on Thursday at 10. Two bills. Yeah, I think so. Well, not as far as I'm concerned. They don't have to be. All right. With that, then, members, thank you for your attention today. It was a long day. We're adjourned.